This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Theatre, film, TV and more. Susie Rong reviews it all on Joy Drive.
Hello, Susie Rong.
Hello, Warren. Do you remember your countdown to the year 2000?
Oh, yes, I do. I do remember it, actually. I remember it very, very well. The year 2000. Gee, that brings back some memories. I was at a party when they had the parties down on the docks here at in Melbourne. And I was at one of these parties. I don't know what it was. I think they were called Red Roar or something like that. And we counted it down.
That sounds really harsh.
Doesn't it? And counted it down. I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, we're here. What did you do?
Yeah, I was at one of those parties down at, I don't know, Horton Pavilion and Royal Hall of Industries, where back in the day, you'd expect every queer person to just be at that one huge party. It's like, I remember back in the day, right? Yeah, it's like the Mardi Gras party was so successful that they would try to replicate it through the year. Mm. So there'll be one, there'll be like, I think two or three more through the year. And New Year's Eve was, I can't remember what it was called. I wonder if it was called Pride. And it was a big New Year's Eve countdown. And obviously, in the year 1999, what anyone would be talking about was what it was going to be like counting down to 2000, because we were terrified that the whole world was going to end in a massive technological catastrophe. So the countdown was, you know, exciting and full of trepidation.
Do you know, I was a bit nervous about what was going to happen in the year 2000, because I was working on a lot of the Y2K bug systems and things at the time for several years leading up to the year 2000. So, and I knew what the implications were if we didn't get it right. And I must admit, I was a little bit nervous as to what was going to happen. But how good was it? Everything ticked over okay, all because we had two digits for a date instead of four.
Yeah. It was a very, very big build-up to that night, that kind of, that worry that all technology, literally, right, we were told that everything was going to shut down. Literally everything was going to shut down at the stroke of midnight, and then we wouldn't know how we were going to survive it. And then nothing happened at all. Can you imagine if we had social media back in the day like that? Can you imagine the all this conspiracy theories that would have come out of
terrible.
That?
Would have been terrible. But you know, I mean, having seen what was going on, something could have happened, but it was all the work that was done that stopped something happening. And I suppose for those who don't know what happened was, you know, all the dates were programmed as two-digit formats. Like today, you know, it would be 26, for example, rather than 2026. And so all the systems were able to cope with going back to 00 from 99.
Yeah.
And that was the problem.
So when nothing happened, it felt like a huge hoax. But, of course, lots of stuff was happening behind the scenes that we didn't know was happening.
Susie, millions. I can tell you millions and millions were spent trying to fix it. But we did. You're right. We got through it. Okay. You know, we're here, Susie. We survived. We probably had more,
it felt
more
like
risk
we were,
at the party.
It felt like we were... Yeah, we felt like we were heading into a new century. It was all super futuristic and exciting. And now 26 years later.
Oh, no. Isn't that scary? Someone says, do you mean sleaze? Oh, yeah, there might have been. Was there a sleaze ball? I think there was a sleaze ball.
Sleaze, I think, was in September.
Oh.
I think sleaze was a September thing. Yeah, there were various. There was one in June, and there was one in September,
That's
and then
right.
There's one for New Year's Eve. There was so much community, so much money in Sydney for this kind of really huge parties. And then with the change in technology and the change in the way people were consuming drugs, it all faded away.
Susie, but the thing is, I don't know, are things more sort of fractured now in terms of where we go, because do we still have the big sort of get-together parties that we had then? I don't know. I don't go.
I know for sure that parties are nothing near
more
that
boutique.
Huge. My impression is that the Mardi Gras party is still probably the biggest party of the year, and from what I can observe, it doesn't take as many spaces as it used to. I remember going down to the showgrounds there, and there were like five different spaces. I doubt if it's anywhere near that size.
There was a round space. I liked the round space. What was that? There was a round building.
The dome.
That's right.
It was the sweatiest one, and that was where you were most likely to see live sex on the dance floor.
Okay, was it? Okay. Yes, the dome. I remember the dome. That was fun. Lots of fun, definitely. Susie, we probably walked, danced past each other then and didn't know that we'd have such a good friendship today.
Oh, I'm sure. Like, we couldn't see past our noses, to be fair.
Susie Rock, I love talking about nostalgia and reminiscing. It's so much fun. Tonight, we're talking about something that is streaming on SBS On Demand. It's called What It Feels Like for a Girl. Give us your review, Susie.
Based on the memoirs of trans writer Paris Lees, the BBC series What It Feels Like for a Girl, now streaming on SBS, tells the story of Lees's youth during the several crucial years before her transition. When we meet Byron, he is only 15, with raging hormones that lead our young protagonist to the discovery of cottaging, or sex in public toilets, before swiftly being enticed into sex work and subsequently an unfortunate detour into drugs and crime. This all happens from the year 2000 in Hucknall, Nottinghamshire, where life is decidedly working class and, painfully for Byron, terribly queerphobic. The series documents their struggles at home, with parents too young and ignorant to offer guidance and support. Byron has to figure life out on their own, and when you're 15, queer, and living away from the cities, it is a grim existence. What It Feels Like for a Girl is an extremely well-made program, but much of it is very hard to watch. It never shies away from showcasing the seriously harsh truths about being on the receiving end of some of life's most cruel treatment of queer people. While the series is always entertaining and intriguing, the urge to look away is ever present. The conclusion does look like it intends to offer some catharsis, but I would say that it never really gets out of the darkness enough to ever feel uplifting. There is an excellent quote in it from Lees. When you force people into the shadows, don't be surprised when they go effing dark. I love that. Watching these authentic renderings of our darkest moments as queer and especially trans people may be tough going, but it's certainly informative. It may even work as therapy. I think a lot of this stuff gets pushed away in our heads, including memories that we don't care to acknowledge. But to look at them through Byron's eyes, I'm sure will ultimately prove rewarding. To truly understand yourself often requires difficult work, but that is the only way a person can grow meaningfully. What It Feels Like for a Girl also demonstrates how queerphobia operates. It has a generosity for its characters that helps us understand that so much of this is the British class system that's working to turn people against one another, so that we are always distracted from the real enemies. Warren, it was a bit of a hard one this week.
It was a hard one to watch this week, but, you know, some good things to come out of it. I mean, I did like going back to the early 2000s. You know, it is set around the Y2K era, as we discussed. I kept thinking about how different it felt back then. You know, there was less language, there was less safety, I suppose. You know, and fewer role models, fewer examples of how to be. I felt like we were just sort of going through life trying to discover how we should be, you know, taking all the knocks and things. You know, who am I? What am I going to be? Where am I going to land? I felt a bit like that. There were less resources out there. Maybe it was just I didn't have access to them and they were there, but it kind of felt like you're a bit more on your own with your friends. Did you find that?
Yeah, it was a really interesting 8-episode stretch of stories, and they're not short episodes, they're like 45 minutes, so it's a really long series. For, you know, these days we seem to be used to 25 minutes and 6 episodes and we're done. This one is long, it's very thorough, and because I knew from the start that it was going to be about this trans writer and how their sort of coming of age, but there is very little about transness for a lot of it, because there simply was no language for it, and there were no kind of role models to understand
what that, Susie?
Paris was.
Why was
because,
that?
Because everything was, what's that called? Gatekept. Everything was gatekept by very few people with the power. And it took a long time for the gay movement to have some power. So by the 2000s, there was prominence about gayness, but it always shut trans people out. It shut a lot of bisexual people out. The language was very simplistic. So even the parties that we were talking at the start of this segment, they were very gay focused. There was a bit of lesbian community there, but it was very gay. Like even when the trans girls, you know, back then, or, you know, whether they call them cross dressers, whatever, or drag queens, they looked like they were presenting, all of them were present. No, I shouldn't say all of them. Most of them were presenting. They were men dressed up as women for a night out for fun. And that was what we saw a lot in this, in this show. Yeah. These girls, they didn't understand. They didn't know that, there were people before them who found ways to live authentically. But what they could see was there were gay men who would take on these characters and come out as knight as an alter ego. And that was what they did. And that was what I did, was how my journey began. I thought, oh, so I can be this person that somehow gives me a lot of joy, but this person is only allowed to emerge sometimes. 'Cause you never saw someone really, you didn't understand that this person could exist the whole time until much later, you know. You know, in my case, I came out, I transitioned about the same time as when Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox came into prominence. And that was, you know, way later. That was like 15 years after this story. So, it was before all of that, and we just didn't know how to talk about ourselves, didn't know how to live a life that felt right for us.
Susie, when you went to these parties, another message came in saying things are more divided by age groups now, which is very sad. But when you went to these parties where you could dress up as you, did you feel more accepted? Did you feel safer than if you had done it and just gone out, say, to a nightclub or something like that?
I don't think there was more safety. I think there was just it was just a freedom that I felt when I was, you know, at that stage, felt like I was in drag. Mm. Because I was dressed as a woman, I felt like I was freer. I didn't have to pretend to be something I wasn't, you know? And, you know, back then, you know, obviously I was very young, I had a lot of desires. I wanted to attract men. I wanted to have sexual and romantic relationships with men. So clubbing had a lot to do with trying to kind of make those connections. So I would do this kind of male drag. And back then, it was a very masculine kind of presentation that was considered desirable. So I would force myself, contort myself into that as masculine as I could do for myself and do club life that way. But It never gave me the freedom that I would feel presenting as a woman, as a drag queen. Except when I presented as a drag queen, I just never had even entertained the idea that I might attract someone in that way.
But were you accepted by the gay men at the time, at these parties you were going to, when you did go out dressed up?
I think I felt tolerated. I felt like they felt like their space was being invaded a little bit. They wanted to create. I often felt like the gay men at that time, I doubt if it's the same now, the gay men at that time just were really, really interested and really kind of focused on creating a very masculine space. Mm. And I think there was so much insecurity about their manhood being kind of, you know, like being gays, right? Emerging out of the dark ages of AIDS and HIV, there was a lot of kind of need for them to demonstrate a kind of a maleness that wasn't weak. So I remember it was to be ultra masculine. So when you have people within that community who might turn up in drag, I don't think they were very excited about it. And I felt like, they kind of tolerated. Some people had an appreciation of it, but I felt like most people just felt like it was a bit of an eyesore, a bit of an inconvenience to have part of drag as their community.
Susie, I love hearing your experience and your reflections and your stories. It's so fascinating. We're talking about what it feels like for a girl, which you can catch on SBS On Demand. Now, Susie, what are we watching next week?
Next week, we're checking out a new movie on the free streaming platform Tubi. It's called Terry Joe, Missionary in Miami. And it promises to be an uproarious satire starring TikTok sensation Terry Joe, famous for being a highly judgmental, Bible-thumping Southern Christian woman. Could be a real hoot for when I see you next Tuesday. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.